It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent RodHunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
Say hello again to my producer, Brendan Thomas.
Hello, Bob. So I'm going to get into our first question here. So I'm going to go to Jeremiah chapter 10, verses 2 through 4. It states, "Learn not the way of the nations, nor be dismayed at the signs of the heavens, because the nations are dismayed at them. For the customs of the peoples are vanity. A tree from the forest is cut down and worked on an axe by the hands of a craftsman. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with hammer and nails so that it cannot move." So it may seem like a silly question, but is this verse forbidding Christmas trees, per se, or
okay,
no?
Well, it's not a silly question because it comes up a lot. And it's very common for Christians to speak against Christmas. And I know you're not one of them,
no.
Brendan. But I do want to say that I have talked to the most sanctimonious, self-righteous Christians to say, oh, we don't celebrate Christmas because it's based on a pagan holiday. And it is true that there was a Roman celebration called Saturnalia, which after Rome was converted to Christianity, they changed that and they celebrated the birth of Christ. I've said this often, if God can convert a heart, if God can convert a soul, God can also convert a holiday. Now, as for the Jeremiah passage, is he talking about Christmas trees? That would be impossible on the face of it because Jeremiah lived hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before the birth of Christ, before there was any celebration of Christmas. Jeremiah was writing and preaching because the nation of Israel was falling into idol worship. He kept warning them that if they continued with this, they were going to be conquered by the nation of Babylon. They did not listen to him. They eventually were conquered by the nation of Babylon, carried off into captivity for years. It was after the Persians conquered the Babylonians and then the Jews were living under Persian rule that the Persian king Artaxerxes allowed the Jews to return to their land. Jeremiah then, in this passage and in so many other passages of the book of Jeremiah, is talking about idol worship. Now, sometimes idols were made out of stone. Sometimes idols were made out of copper or out of silver or out of gold. Here he's talking about one that starts with a wooden base. But if you continue reading in that chapter, you see him mentioning the word idol. It is an idol that he is talking about here. He's not talking about celebrating Christ with a Christmas tree.
Right.
Now, if somebody feels that they can't in good conscience put up a Christmas tree because it takes away from Christ, that's fine. But if somebody else puts up a tree, we're doing that to celebrate Christ. God knows our hearts. God knows that's why we're doing it. That is not what Jeremiah was talking about. It was a warning against idol worship. Now, if somebody put up a Christmas tree and they decided that they were some tree hugger and they were worshiping nature instead of worshiping Christ, that would be a problem. So a Christmas tree or the decoration of any kind of tree could be an issue if the person's actually worshiping the tree, but that's not what Christians, for the most part, are doing when they put up a Christmas tree.
Right.
Idol worship was what they were doing, however, in the days of Jeremiah.
Gotcha. Hey, speaking of this kind of topic, have you gotten a chance to see Saving Christmas yet? It's a Kirk Cameron film where he is trying to persuade people that all the Christmas traditions are actually not from pagan traditions, but they're actually Christian traditions.
I have heard of that film, and of course I've seen other things by Cameron. I have not seen that one. Did you like it?
Personally, no. He made no sense at all in this whole
movie.
Was
it because it was bad art artistically, or was it the message that you disagreed with?
There's two messages. I absolutely disagree with him. Otherwise, it's the art for sure, because it's a 70-minute movie, and I'm not kidding you, 50 minutes of this movie is two guys sitting in a car talking. It's so boring.
Well, now, if it's a fascinating conversation, I'll give them some leeway. But if it's a boring conversation, that's another story.
There's a movie back in the 80s called like Dinner With...
My Dinner With Andre. Was it like that? Because that was supposed to be a fascinating movie, even though the whole thing was two guys in a restaurant talking.
It ain't no My Dinner With Andre.
Okay. All right. Well, we were talking about this the other day. I was getting into a discussion with a friend. We were talking about the movie Ben-Hur. Uh-huh. He was talking about, it's 4 hours long. I don't believe that the length of something determines whether it's too long. I believe whether or not it's boring determines whether it's too long. The Ten Commandments, Ben-Hur, 4 hours each movie, but you're on the edge of your seats for the most part. There could be another movie that's only 40 minutes and it might bore you to death because of the subject matter. So I'm glad you made that comparison, because you're not saying that simply because the whole thing's a conversation that automatically makes it boring. You're just saying this was not an interesting conversation.
Right, right. I mean, I sat through, I know this is completely different, but The Avengers End of Ultron is 3 hours long and I loved every second of it. I was on the edge of my seat for every action scene, every dialogue. I was really enthralled with, but this is, again, it's only 70 minutes, but it feels like a long one. The two points I disagree with him, one of the points he's made is talk about how the Christmas tree is a Christian object. Here's the reason why. Christ died on the cross. What was that cross made from?
Wood. Oh, is he trying to say because Christ died on the cross? Yes.
And I'm like,
I mean, we always need to give some latitude. The Romans did decorate trees for the winter solstice.
Right.
Did the Romans have a pagan festival that got converted to Christianity? Yes, but I always like to add my so what? If we know in our hearts that we're worshiping Christ, we know in our hearts that we're worshiping Christ. It's that simple.
Exactly. The last thing I didn't agree with him in terms of the messaging was near the end where he says, and if you want those big presents and everything for yourself, go ahead, do it. And he says the reason why is because we're taking from the material of Jesus, thus we're celebrating those objects. And I'm like, but isn't that still greed? And I thought greed's a sin.
To be fair to him, I would have to watch the movie and hear it in context. But to just answer your question at face value, gifts are something neutral. Somebody can be giving gifts with greed in mind, that if they give an expensive gift, they expect one in return. Somebody could be doing it just out of the generosity of their heart. Somebody might be wealthy and they might give a Porsche to their daughter, but they're doing it out of love. Somebody may be a pauper and they're making a paper doll to give to their daughter, but they're doing that in love. So the gift is neutral. The motivation is everything. That would be my cursory answer to that, because I haven't had a chance to hear Cameron.
I wish he added that option about the motivation, because what I remember from the film, he just said it's okay to be greedy because we're taken from the material of Jesus.
The Bible says greed is wrong.
So. I got it. No. It's okay to be materialistic. I got it. He said it's okay to be materialistic because we're taking from the material of Jesus. That's what he said.
Okay, I would say that the word materialistic, like the word gift, could be a neutral word depending on, like when people say, well, capitalism is evil. Well, greedy capitalism is evil.
Right.
But capitalism is a free monetary system that keeps us from the tyranny of socialism and communism is not evil. So again, a lot of it goes back to motive. A lot of it goes back to how it's being used.
Yeah, okay. So I really don't want to go back to that movie, but I'll have to rewatch it at some point and be more contextual with some of these things.
Well, I should watch it myself so that maybe the next time we discuss it, I could talk as one who was informed, but I'm just giving, again, a surface answer to your questions.
Okay, so let's move on to our next question here. These are a bunch of Genesis questions. So we're going to start off with Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. It says, then God said, let us make a man in our image according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on earth. Now, my question to you is, because he's using words like us and our, is it implying that there was multiple gods creating life or no?
Okay, well, that's a very good question. It is one that has puzzled many people. And this is a great example, Brendan, of putting scripture in the context. Because if Genesis chapter 1 was the only chapter in the entire Bible, we didn't have any other information and any other place where God was talking or teaching or interacting, certainly that would be a very fair question. Is the Bible teaching that we were created by many gods? The teaching of the Bible, and I went through this earlier in the show, is that God exists as a triunity. He is somehow three persons in one Godhead. And it is the Trinity talking to itself when it says, let us. So yes, it is plurality. In fact, the very word for God, Elohim, that word itself in Hebrew is a plural unity word. So the plurality is right in the very name God itself.
Okay, so it's a trinity of
it's the trinity there. Talking now, there are Jewish sages and rabbis today don't believe in the trinity, even though the trinity can be found in the Old Testament as well, but they don't believe in that, but neither do they believe there are other gods. So to the Jewish people, a lot of the common interpretation of that is that God is talking to angels. But there's a problem with that, because the Bible doesn't teach that we're made in the image of angels. It teaches that we're made in the image of God. And God there is saying, let us make man in our own image. So did he ever consult with the angels about things like a committee meeting? I suppose that's possible, but that doesn't seem to be what's going on here in Genesis chapter 1.
Right. We're only made in the likeness. And besides that, it's impossible for any man or woman to even know what God looks like in the first place.
Oh, yeah. Yes, image means spiritual image.
Right, right.
Like God is a creator, we create. I like to create books and stories. Some people create computer programs. Some people are architects.
Right, right. Okay, so let's move on to the next one here. In Genesis 18, there were three men that appeared to Abraham. However, different religions say different things on who these three men are. So, who were these three men exactly?
Well, they actually end up getting identified, because two of them end up going into Sodom, and we learn that they were angels. Now,
right.
Here's a case. It's just right. Funny that it comes after that other verse, because here's an instance where God is working with some angels. So two of them go into Sodom and are angels. The third one that stays behind, the one that's talking to Abraham, Abraham eventually refers to him as God, as the Lord. So this is what we would call a theophany, or some would call it a when I mentioned a moment ago that there are examples of the Trinity in the Old Testament, this was a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, when Jesus was born through Mary, his mother, we call that an incarnation, because even though he had been God by identity, the second person of the Trinity, he became a real human being, born of a mother. He had the limitations of a human being. He could be hurt. He could bleed. He could die. He was not born with a sin nature, but he was tempted to sin, never gave into the temptation, and he paid the penalty for us, and then he resurrected from the dead, but we're going to resurrect from the dead someday too. He returned to heaven and rules again as God, but he's staying in the form of a man. Apparently that was an eternal sacrifice to remind us for all of eternity what the second person of the Trinity was willing to do. So we call that the incarnation. Now, what do we mean by pre-incarnation? Well, here, God the Son, or in those days, he would have been known as God the Messenger, or God the Word, the expression of God. He's just coming, and he's coming in the appearance of a man. That's this time.
Okay.
There are other times he appeared as if he was a flame of fire.
Right, with like Moses.
With Moses. It says the angel of the Lord. Now, we have to be careful with the word angel, because we hear the word angel, we think of these beings with wings in heaven. Well, there are beings in heaven with wings, and they are called angels. But the word angel literally means messenger. So there's these creatures that are messengers of God, but there was also this very special middle person of the Trinity who acted. His responsibility amongst the Trinity was to be the message and manifestation to people. So when God communicated in Old Testament days, it was through the angel of the Lord, which simply means the messenger of the Lord. This was not one of those angelic beings with wings. And John, using the Greek language, refers to him as the Word. You go to John, the Gospel, the very first chapter. He says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then you go right to verse 14, and the Word became flesh, and we beheld his glory. Glory is of the only begotten Son of the Father. He makes it very clear
right. Who
he became. So that was the incarnation. Abraham, when he starts bargaining with this man and says, well, what if there's five righteous people in the city? And the guy says, all right, if there's five righteous people, I won't destroy it. He's bargaining with them. Well, that's somebody who, when he first met him, he thought he was a man. Somewhere in the conversation, it was revealed to Abraham who he was really talking to. We're not given the detail. I'd love to have the detail of what it was that finally tipped Abraham off who he was talking to. But at the beginning of the conversation, these are just a couple of strangers, and he welcomes them. By the end of the conversation, he knows he's talking to God, but he knows when he faces this man that he's not looking at what God really looks like. He's not going, okay, oh, God has a face like me, and God has eyes, and God has a nose. No, this was a manifestation, as you said it so well yourself. At another time when God speaks to Moses, he comes as a fire that's burning a bush and not consuming it. Different manifestations of the angel of God.
Gotcha. So are any of these angels similar with each other throughout the Bible? For example, there was an angel that came down to Mary and said, do not be afraid. Is this a similar angel, or does he have angels like galore to be like, hey, you send this message over.
There are many different angels. Okay. There are some angels that have names that recur. There's an angel named Gabriel. There's an angel named Michael. So occasionally there are angels with names and we're familiar with them. Other times it's just an angel. One of the fascinating verses, and this gets back to the story of Abraham in Hebrews, it says, do not be afraid to entertain strangers, for in doing so, some have entertained angels unaware. And this story in Genesis with Abraham is a perfect example of that. These were just some strangers. He was showing them that Middle East hospitality.
Yep.
And it turned out it was an actual angel in his house.
How about that? Okay. Well, we only have time for one more question.
Okay.
So let's see if we get to it here. We're going to go to, again, the last Genesis here. Genesis chapter 22, verse 12. That one says, and he said, do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now, I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Open theists have said that we should look at this verse in the Bible and take it strictly as what they say. Of course, there are times when we should do that and other times where we shouldn't, which you've discussed plenty of times before. Nevertheless, the open theists conclude that God had to learn what Abraham would do. God had to learn. But if we just assume that God had to learn, then other problems arise when we examine this text in the light. So what's your opinion on how we should look into this verse exactly?
Okay, well, the Bible teaches from beginning to end that God is all-knowing. God knows everything.
In 1 John, right? If I remember.
There's many, yeah.
Oh, many times.
It's many places, many places. Mm-hmm. And what the open theists are trying to say here is, well, if God says, now I know, Abraham, that you love me above all else. Well, look, here's an example of something that God did not know. This is what we call an anthropomorphism. God is relating to us. The Bible says that God exists outside of time. Now, it is true that Abraham was created with a free will and God wanted to see what he was going to do. But he knew what Abraham was going to do before Abraham was even created because he's completely outside of time. Now, we can say as God was looking at Abraham outside of time, he saw that choice. But what I'm saying is a prophet that lived 500 years before Abraham could have said, God told me what Abraham's going to do. So God sees it, but he sees it with a vision that's beyond ours. What's really going on there is now Abraham knew that he put God above all else. In the context here, for those of you that are just jumping in or aren't familiar with this verse, God had promised a son to Abraham, even though Abraham and his wife were beyond the years when his wife could bear a child. It was a miraculous son. His name was Isaac. And then later on, after Isaac's been alive for a while, God says, take your son and offer him to me. Now, we immediately look at that and we go, well, that's a barbaric practice. Well, that is a barbaric practice, but that's a practice that the ancient Canaanite gods had. Later on, when God sends Moses, God's going to make it clear that he finds that practice barbaric. But Abraham didn't yet understand that. Abraham grew up in a culture where if the God you're worshiping tells you to put your son on the altar, that was actually a very natural thing. So Abraham wasn't sitting there going, gee, what a barbaric God. He was saying, wait a minute, I'm a little confused. I thought God gave me this son and now my son who's so important to me, I've got to give him back. But Abraham finally said, okay, I choose God and my allegiance and obedience to God even over my son. And then when he did that, it's kind of like the old bloopers and practical jokes or candid camera. God says, whoa, I'm just testing you. Didn't really want you to do it. Just wanted to see if you'd be willing. It was really Abraham who learned what he was willing to do. Obviously, God already knew. But we've got to allow for God to speak like that. He may be removed from time and know everything already, but we're not removed from time.
Right.
People could just as easily say, well, why even pray to God? Before you even open your mouth, he knows what you want. He knows what you need. He knows what you're going to ask. That's true. But the prayer is for our benefit, not God's. How are we going to have an interaction with him and a one-on-one relationship, which implies dialogue and talking and sometimes asking rhetorical questions like when God asked Adam and Eve, where are you? Mm-hmm. He knew where they were.
Yeah.
And we do that all the time. We allow for that with parents and children. When the mother says, Johnny, did you put your hands in the cookie jar? Well, the kid's got fudge all over his face and hands halfway out. She knows the answer to that question. She's asking the question for his benefit. So it's the same in our interaction
right,
with
going
God.
Going back to your Adam and Eve thing, he put the apple tree there for a reason. He knew that there was temptation there. And us humans weren't going to make that mistake. We were going to sin at some point. So therefore, he already knew ahead of time, like, okay, well, obviously these guys are imperfect creatures, but I could still work.
The fruit was a test. We actually don't know if it was an apple, but it was some kind of fruit. Oh. I would say if I had been there and it had been a pear tree, I would not have sinned because I hate pears.
I'm with you. So I'm with you on that
if
one.
If only I had been Adam and if only it had been a pear tree. Okay.
Yes.
I'm Dr. David Poole, president of San Diego Christian College. At SDCC, you'll find a number of dynamic degree and certificate programs, including business, aviation, kinesiology, education, psychology, ministry, and more. Our curriculum blends academic excellence with a Christian worldview, ensuring you graduate ready to make a meaningful impact. Your journey starts here. Learn more at sdcc.edu. That's sdcc.edu. San Diego Christian College. Begin your journey.
This question deals with earth continuing forever and ever. Ecclesiastes chapter 1 verse 4 says, "A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever." However, there are many other Bible verses that say the opposite of that. And I use the examples of Isaiah chapter 65, verse 17.
Where it says there'll be a new earth someday.
Correct, yeah. And then some other ones I can read off too. But they basically say what you're saying. It's a new heaven in place. So which is correct? Is there a new heaven in place, or will the earth continue forever?
Well, Ecclesiastes was a poetic book. And so we need to give it the license of poetry. This is somebody writing, probably King Solomon. It's ascribed to him, and he's getting very frustrated. And so it's just a common figure of speech. We have trials and our lives come to an end, but the world goes on. It's like he's saying life goes on. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he was trying to make a theological statement there about a new heaven and a new earth. And even in the new earth, the human beings that were in this earth that are walking with God will still live there. So it could even be argued that the earth is going to go on, but in a recreated state. But we wouldn't want to try to develop too much theology from a poetic book in the Bible. It seems to just be a loose way of saying life goes on, and he phrased it a certain way.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So that's actually the actual Bible poetry that you were...
Probably. Yes, Ecclesiastes, Job would be another one, Psalms, okay. Proverbs. You just don't look at that the same way you'd look at a book like Romans, because Romans was an actual letter that Paul had teaching in.
Well, even then, I find Jesus' parables almost like a riddle where I have to decipher what he truly...
Parables were a very unique type of Hebrew literature, too. And so this is why when people think they can just open up the Bible and read it, it comes from a completely different culture. It was written in completely different languages. Time. It has to be studied. And if we don't have the time to study, that's why commentaries are important. But we have to be careful because sometimes the commentator throws his opinion in.
No, totally.
I'd like commentators that just say, here's the historical situation in those days. Here's some different possibilities of what might have been going on. And then they leave it up to us instead of just treating us like children and explaining to us what it meant.
Totally. Because here I am saying all these Bible verses to you, and I'm almost feeling like, oh, are they meaning these things literally? And then here you are explaining, no. Here's
but you're asking different... good questions.
Oh,
at least you're asking that. You're not making an assumption. You're saying, boy, this looks like there's more to this than meets the eye. That's a very good place to start.
I think so, too. So, and with more research. And again, you're always a good resource to help me out with all those things.
I appreciate that. Yeah. And of course, I've had to do research. And
yes.
So it goes on and on. Yes,
absolutely.
The Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the Law Offices of Matthew Simone.